What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss. As we've done just about every Monday since October, we'll turn back today to our recurring segment, The Palestine Post, talking about the latest news from Israel's genocide in Gaza and the efforts that people are taking from across the world to stop it. Today, we're joined by Nora Barrows-Friedman, a staff writer and editor at the Electronic Intifada, and also a former KPFA host and producer, along with Nadia Tanous, a researcher, writer, and veteran organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement. Nora and Nadia, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Jesse.
Thanks for having us.
Before the end of the hour, we'll get into conversations about the latest on the ground. We'll also discuss the desperate need for aid, the role of protest in the U.S., and crucially, what we actually mean when referring to a ceasefire. But first, I want to start with the latest breaking news, which is that just 20 minutes ago or so, the UN Security Council voted for an actual legally binding resolution for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza during the holy month of Ramadan. It calls for a lasting, sustainable ceasefire, not a permanent ceasefire. Nora, I want to bring you in first. What are your thoughts on the UN Security Council's ceasefire resolution? Again, this just passed 20 minutes ago.
Yeah. It took 6 months for a resolution like this to be passed in the first place without the U.S. immediately vetoing it. Today, they abstained, which I don't know how much better it is, because, yeah, like as you said, the ceasefire doesn't call for a permanent and lasting ceasefire. It's just basically a temporary ceasefire. It doesn't address the myriad and overwhelming number of war crimes that Israel continues to commit on a minute-to-minute basis over the last 6 months in Gaza. I don't see how it can be enforced at this time because, you know, of course, at the end of January, nearly 2 months ago now, the International Court of Justice at The Hague ruled that Israel was plausibly committing acts of genocide, and it laid out the ways in which Israel should stop doing that. And of course, we've seen the acceleration of genocide in Gaza over the last 2 months. I'm not sure what this means. I know that, you know, the U.S.'s ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfeld, has been towing the Biden administration's line in terms of not requiring Israel to do anything. In terms of, you know, stopping its genocidal acts, the U.S. is continuing to provide cover for Israel's genocide. And I'm still trying to figure out, you know, what this all means. But without enforcement, it's just, kind of symbolic at this point.
Well, Nora, I'd like to push back on you just for one moment on this. There's been calls for a ceasefire from all parts of the international community, including pro-Palestine protesters, pro-Palestine organizers from around the world. Now, we know that perhaps the UN Security's ceasefire resolution doesn't necessarily mean that there will be any type of a ceasefire. We can't know yet how it will land on the ground, but there has to be some good in a moving forward, at least of the conversation around the potential for a ceasefire. Sure, it should have come 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously, this is what the world has been demanding for 6 months. And it's good that this was passed. The language was very much watered down. It still, kind of equivocates Israel's crimes with Palestinian resistance, which is wholly unacceptable in a lot of people's views. But again, like without any teeth, without any enforcement, especially by Israel's co-authors of this genocide, namely the US and the UK, I'm not sure what actual material good it will do. I mean, hopefully this will, I don't know, empower other, you know, third party states, for example, to levy other resolutions against Israel. I mean, we saw just in the last couple of weeks, Nicaragua is now bringing a case against Germany to the World Court over Germany's complicity in Israel's genocide and its failure to stop this genocide. And I think, you know, maybe with this ceasefire resolution, it will encourage other states to bring other states involved in this atrocity to the World Court. I mean, maybe I'm just very pessimistic at this point when we see the wholesale slaughter live streamed on TV and on our phones for the last 6 months. I think a watered down resolution that only applies to the next 2 weeks, which of course won't be followed up with, is just yet another slap in the face to Palestinians.
I hear the pessimism, and I certainly agree that it's been earned. Nora, you said that the UN's ceasefire resolution equivocates Israel's crimes with Palestinian resistance. In just a few minutes, I'm going to ask you to explain what you mean by that, because I think it's important. But first, I want to bring in Nadia Tanous into the conversation. Nadia, what's your reaction to the UN Security Council's resolution?
I think, as Nora started and said, it's been 6 months where this has been brought to the table and shot down by the United States. I mean, just thinking that this current ceasefire resolution rests on the shoulders of four failed ceasefire resolutions. And at this point, Jesse, I don't know how many people are dead, how many people are injured, and how many people are missing. But what we've seen in the 6 months of the U.S., buying time with, you know, giving cover for Israel's goal to really destroy the Gaza Strip, all of its infrastructure, and the spirit of the Palestinian people to crush us and their insurmountable military pressure. I think what we can see from this ceasefire resolution today is a little bit of a success. We know that the ceasefire is not going to be permanent because it doesn't fit Israel's goals, which has always been, since the beginning, to destroy Gaza in its entirety and to leave way for a new frontier for Israel's colonization and particularly destruction of any semblance of Palestinian sovereignty. Resistance and fortification on the land. I think what the ceasefire resolution does do, what I see in the past 20 minutes of this news, is that it further isolates Israel in the international community. And I think what I'm most interested in is what else is going to happen with negotiations. Does this put pressure on Israel to come to the negotiation table and make different concessions than it previously has? Like last night before I went to bed, I was reading kind of how things are going. And Israel had said, okay, you know, maybe we'll exchange 40, you know, the 40 Israelis for 800 Palestinian prisoners, total, and 100 of them that are high sentence. And so, you know, for me, I think I'm interested in how the ceasefire fits into a myriad of other things. But surely one thing we can say is that with the curbing of aid, right? UNRWA again was completely disallowed all of their convoys this morning before the ceasefire resolution was passed. They banned all UNRWA convoys into northern Gaza once again. So with the lack of aid and actual access that our people have to critical life-saving food, right? Water and medicine, at least what ceasefire may do for the next 2 weeks is stop imminent destruction of more Palestinian infrastructure. Now, how this correlates, as Nora was saying, with actual enforcement, ground troops, and you know, is it a two-week ceasefire ahead of an Israeli ground invasion? We simply don't know. But I am grateful for a little bit of reprieve, because any cessation in bombing does save life. Mm-hmm. And y'all have heard me say this many times, genocide is not a metaphor. You either live or you die. And we want our people to live.
I wanted to just lift up what Nadia was saying, and that, yeah, any cessation of this relentless bombing campaign is welcome. I hope that happens. And first and foremost, I hope it happens today. I don't see that happening, unfortunately. And that's really really worrying that, you know, while the so-called international community is like trying to figure out the wording of a watered down resolution, that this is still happening to Palestinians. But it also is, I mean, thanks for alleviating some of my pessimism there, Nadia, because I, you know, it just reminded me that, like, yeah, Israel is being isolated. Israel is fast becoming the world pariah, and that can't happen soon enough. But it is accelerating. And that, you know, Israel is always making these plans about, you know, the so-called day after, right? We see all these settlers in the, you know, like blocking the aid trucks to get into Gaza every day, and supported and encouraged by the Israeli military and the Israeli police. And you know, all these settlers are talking about how they're going to build these, like, you know, resorts on the ruins, literally on people's bones right now in Gaza. And I think the more that we can dismiss that, I mean, they're, you know, you have to win the war first in order to talk about the day after the war, and they are not winning. They are not winning. They will not win this. And you know, this UN resolution hopefully is like the first step in, you know, in isolating Israel at this level. More needs to happen, obviously, but it's a good reminder to us that we shouldn't be giving any oxygen to Israel and the US's, you know, plans for the so-called day after. And I think, you know, as Israel becomes more isolated, so is the U.S. And that's always good from an anti-imperialist lens.
Nora, earlier I said I wanted to go back to you about something you said. I think it's worth pointing out, as we get back to that, that the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. just after the resolution was passed said, and this is a quote, "A ceasefire of any duration must come with a release of all hostages."
Mm-hmm.
So, Nora, a few minutes ago, you said that the UN's ceasefire resolution equivocates Israel's crimes with Palestinian resistance. I think the conversation about hostages as opposed to prisoners does mm-hmm. part of that. But I'm wondering if you can bring us into exactly what you meant by that, and how it's challenging in the international discourse.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, that was precisely what I was talking about, is this, like, you know, this attempt to equalize, you know, the Israeli captives, which are, you know, a lot are high level military officers belonging to Israel's southern Gaza command, who were captured by the Palestinian resistance on October 7th. And then it's unclear actually, which so-called hostages are identified by this Security Council resolution? Is it the prisoners in administrative detention? There are thousands of Palestinians in Israeli detention without charge or trial. I would consider that, I would consider them captives, obviously, hostages of the Israeli settler state. Is it the women and children in prison? Is it people who have been rearrested after they were released during the very, brief window of time in November when there was an exchange? It's unclear. And then of course it kind of I don't know, it supports the US's this like narrative around all the basically like Hamas has to surrender and not have anything in return. That's the US's position. That Israel gets to, keep bombing or maybe lessen the bombing a little bit. Israel gets to be the administrative, occupier of Gaza and the West Bank. And Israel gets to, carry on kidnapping, abducting, and detaining Palestinians at will. There's not anything on the U.S. side. And then as soon as, the Palestinians say, no, we're not going to agree to that. The U.S. gets to say, oh, so you don't want a ceasefire. And that's been the U.S.'s position for the last 6 months. And so this, this U.N. Security Council resolution, I just kind of saw that wording about the so-called hostages. I think a lot of people are asking for more detail. Anyway, that was what I was talking about.
Nadia, do you have thoughts to chime in? We've had many conversations that personally, although not on the air, about what a ceasefire means, as it is a primary demand of pro-Palestine and pro-human protests around the world. So I guess my question is, how does the conversation around hostages and prisoners, et cetera, impact a conversation about what it means for these bodies to call for a ceasefire and what that word actually means, as certainly as it's landing on the ground in Palestine, but also the word that is used as the primary demand of social movements across the world right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we've talked about ceasefire, in the streets, it's been one of the most kind of bottom line uniting slogans of all of this activity around Palestine, this wave of people coming onto the streets, people of conscience from around the world, calling for Palestinian liberation and freedom. Ceasefire, as we've always said, is the political floor. It doesn't address the lifting the siege of Gaza. It doesn't address the 75, almost 76 year Israeli occupation of Palestine. It doesn't address the routine imprisonment of Palestinians and actually the doubled population of Palestinian prisoners since October, from 5,000 now to over 10, I think it's 11,000 people. It doesn't address the right of return and the rights of Palestinian people to self-determination, to our homeland from the river to the sea. So ceasefire doesn't address any of the central core demands of the Palestinian people, which I just listed. But it does address, as we've been saying, right, this really material need for Israel to stop decimating the Gaza Strip from the sky. We know that any amount of humanitarian aid that enters the Gaza Strip cannot undo what one night of Israeli bombing can do. That's the level of destruction. Just every single night, there's a new reality on the ground in a humanitarian sense. Now, in a political sense, the reality is very much the the same. It's consistent, right? We as Palestinian people know what our needs are. And one of the really central demands for anyone who's actually, you know, studied our struggle, taken this time to build relationships and spoken with us, I think we know that prisoners are always key in these negotiations. And that's because it's not just about loss of land. It's also about the future of our people. What will the infrastructure look like building towards actual rebuilding of Palestine, right? And that rebuilding has to be through more than just physical infrastructure. The Palestinian prisoners who we're talking about are the leadership of the Palestinian people. They are some of the most committed organizers. They are the folks who in the 1980s were able to actually rebuild Palestinian societal infrastructure so that we could have what was known as the Intifada of Stones or the First Intifada. We have to remember that there was a huge prisoner release for 6 Israeli hostages. There were 4,000 Palestinian prisoners that were released 2 years before the Intifada began. That was very intentional. That was because it was necessary for leadership to be released from prison in order to build a society that could sustain itself in the face of mass Israeli aggression, in the face of, you know, containing communities in order to starve them, actually, in order to induce famine. Palestinians had developed everything from small-scale sustainable farming practices so they can boycott Israeli goods, all the way through to, local committees, grassroots committees that dealt with various social issues, needs, requirements for people, everything from health to students, women, and of course, agriculture. So this is kind of what we're looking at in this moment. And it's why in the negotiations, Hamas has been so intentional about demanding the release of Palestinian prisoners. We remember the first negotiation table, the demand really was all for all Palestinians held hostage for all Israeli hostages. And that's been the demand. Even last night, when we see 800 Palestinian prisoners, that was from the Israeli side that was offered, right? And 100 of them being high profile. I mean, if we don't understand the context of what Palestinian prisoners have meant to the Palestinian struggle, then we're not going to understand why this is such a central point in negotiations. But Jesse, it's more than just about land. It's also about future. How are we as the Palestinian people going to come out of this moment of immense devastation? I'm not talking about healing. You don't heal from genocide. It's happened. We have to be able to have an eye on what it means for our people who have survived this and for the millions of us who have now spent 3-4 generations in exile waiting for justice, which the international community has never offered us, which is why the Palestinian people have always said we have to acquire it ourselves. Part of that is through the release of the Palestinian prisoners and through achieving a dignity where we actually are able to say, okay, we're going to have a future that isn't predicated on international aspirations for us, because the aspiration out of the last 6 months has been, we don't really care if you live or you die. We just want to punish you forever, ever thinking that you could be free. I just want to note also that Israel, you had said this, Nora, Israel is becoming more and more of a pariah state. I think this is really a good thing, because in the first 2 weeks of October, you know, Israel said, we're actually going to throw out this very carefully crafted narrative of the Israeli military being the most moral army in the world. We're going to take all the PR that we've shielded Israel with, and we're going to just throw it in the bin so that we can be as violent And as treacherous as possible against the Palestinian people. But they're not infallible, y'all. Like, we're on this interview now, and literally on my phone, I have this little alert popping up. Netanyahu calls off senior aide's DC trip after US abstains on the UN Gaza resolution. So Netanyahu is now punishing the United States for abstaining, right? Rather than blocking a resolution on ceasefire. You can see, even as US and Israeli interests are indelibly aligned, that there is also cracks and pressure developing between the US and Israel, not because of the goals for Palestine, which is to fundamentally destroy any semblance of our presence on the land and any possibility of us establishing an actual nation. But what their disagreement is on the process of getting there. And so as these things also continue, I think having a crack in that foundation on strategy between the US and Israel, the US, Israel's largest global supporter, I think this is a real good thing.
Nora, in just a minute, I'm going to ask you to chime in. But first, I thought one thing that is important to add to the conversation, we hear these resolutions being brought up to the UN and the UN Security Council. One thing that is not as nearly as much discussed in media in the US is the ceasefire proposals that are being brought to the table to negotiate actually between Hamas representatives and Israeli representatives. And I wanted to read through the latest proposal that's been publicized. This is coming straight from Al Jazeera. It was published last week. These are the main points that Hamas brought to the table, and I think they really fall in line with what Nadia was describing a minute ago. The Hamas proposal for a ceasefire, and I'm reading again from Al Jazeera, would say that Israeli captives would be released in exchange for Palestinian prisoners, 100 of whom are serving life sentences. Nearly 100 captives are believed to be in the custody of Hamas and the other Palestinian factions. Still, the ceasefire would be divided into three stages lasting 42 days. The first stage would release women and children who are captives. In exchange, 700 to 1,000 Palestinian prisoners would be released. In the second phase, a permanent ceasefire, again using the word permanent, must be declared before any more captives are released. And then the third stage would involve Israel lifting its siege on Gaza and initiating the rebuilding of the enclave. So again, this, just as Nadia was describing, the demand is for the political project that Palestinians have been moving for basic dignity for a long time. Nora, I'm wondering if you can respond certainly to these proposals as well as to what Nadia brought to the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think those proposals brought by Hamas and other parties of the Palestinian resistance are incredibly dignified. And that's like basic minimum. It also kind of breaks this facade that the U.S. and the West in general, and Israel, of course, has tried to create about Hamas as, this monstrous boogeyman of a band of savage Palestinians, right? And not who they really are, which is a legitimate political party that is engaged in political, diplomacy and negotiations. And with these proposals that they have been trying to get Israel to negotiate. I mean, the fact that like Israel is even having to negotiate with Hamas is already a political defeat for Israel itself. And Hamas, if you look through these proposals, the what they're saying is entirely legitimate. Release all of our, people in prisons, which is, Israel's obligation under international law to begin with. It is illegal for an occupying entity to transfer members of the occupied population into its custody. So the fact that there is even Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons is already a violation of international law. To end this 17-year siege on the Gaza Strip, this is entirely, a legitimate demand. And to, basic like humanitarian rights for Palestinians. And again and again and again, the Israelis and the U.S. Counterparts are sticking their foot in the gears of that negotiation process and demanding that basically like what the U.S. and Israel wants Palestinians to do is to just surrender, to give up, to surrender, and to concede to every one of Israel's demands. And Palestinians are not going to do that. And they've been very dignified in their stance. And I think that's also showing people all over the world who are, struggling under the boot of imperialism and settler colonialism and the demands by the West. That there is another way that people have the space to try and govern themselves and not capitulate to these like inhuman demands of just surrender and death. Basically Israel and the U.S.'s demands for the Palestinians is just to shut up and die. And Palestinians aren't taking that. And I think that these negotiations, at some point, Israel is going to have to be the one to capitulate. Israel is going to have to be the one to admit that it has achieved zero of its military goals, besides ethnic cleansing and genocide, that it is becoming a pariah, that it is becoming a risky or bad investment economically. I mean, its GDP has plunged, more than, I think, 20% in the last couple of months. It's settlers are fleeing. The Israeli state is in a downward spiral internally. And at some point, they're going to have to face up to reality. And this is, I think this is just the reality that Israel is slowly coming to terms with, and Palestinians in their full dignity, acting as state, a real state, a diplomatic state, with these negotiations. I mean, it just shows the stark reality more and more.
I want to bring in the context of international law. From our understanding, because this was passed by the UN Security Council, it is actually binding according to international law. That said, we know that Israel has violated international law consistently and in many ways has shown their commitment to not basing their policies on international law. The U.S., as a primary supporter of Israel, has not enforced international law in its relationship with Israel. I'm wondering, how do we grapple with any value coming from a source of international law, and how can we use some semblance of an ideal coming from the UN? I guess I'll toss that to either of you. Maybe we can start with Nadia.
Yeah, I mean, the United Nations often is more like a theater than a platform for actual conversations of the needs of justice or balancing powers. I think what we can see now, as we've always seen, is what is present in the political will of the states who have hegemony over world affairs. I mean, namely the United States and its allies, who are clearly positioned to veto the proposals or very necessary assessments of the common situation of and context of the world, and instead, you know, align the UN's outcomes really with their imperialist interests. I think like one thing that's kind of interesting when we talk about this as a theater is it seems like the US didn't block this, but did abstain from the current resolution that passed, because there were certain key edits that were ignored, including their request to add a condemnation of Hamas. I think that's really interesting, because what it shows actually is the position that the U.S. has been put in due to mounting pressure, as they've also tried to say time and time again, justice for the Palestinian people or this demand for a free Palestine is a minority stance or an isolated opinion. I just don't think they can say this anymore. I think what we're looking at this moment in this theater of the United Nations is actually the political will of the rest of the world, which the US has also isolated itself from, particularly on this issue. I don't know what it means, Jesse, to look to the UN to be the arbiter of justice. I also don't understand why we expect the United States to be an arbiter of justice in that space. But what I do think is resounding here is that actually for the first time in our history as the Palestinian people, we may have facets of international law that we can actually wield against the state of Israel. Previously, the Nakba and the genocide of 1948 was not recognized. It was systematically ignored by the United Nations. If we look at the Convention on the Status of Refugees, right, you can see the way that Article 1D has conditionally included the Palestinian people into the convention, but has placed us under a completely different body than the rest of the refugee populations in the world. Every other refugee population is served by the UN High Commissioner of Refugees, or UNHCR. We, the Palestinian people, are served under UNRWA, and we're the only refugee population to be kind of isolated in that way, which is why UNRWA has been attacked so vehemently, because it's one of the only legs we have that actually provides food security, security of medicine, education systems, all of this for Palestinian refugee populations, about a third of us who live as refugees in camps. And so this is really critical infrastructure. I think what we need to understand also as the UN as a theater is that as we see the ceasefire resolution, what does that actually mean for Palestinian survival? Does it mean an increase of food? Does it mean the ability for Palestinians in Gaza to access water? Does it mean life-saving medication? Does it mean a curbing in so many of the viruses, deadly diseases that are coming back to the Gaza Strip, to the Palestinian population? It doesn't mean that. So we also need to make sure that we're not distracted by the fanfare of the platform of the UN and kind of the heavy articulations that happen within those corridors. We need to really focus on materially what's happening on the ground. We've spent 6 months highlighting everything that's happening. And Nora, I listen to your program every time y'all release it, pretty much every morning, every week. Multiple times a week, I've woken up with Nora Barris Friedman and Ali Abunema and your team in order to listen to updates, real solid, clear updates from what is happening on the ground. We need to make sure that, particularly in this moment, we are not swayed or distracted. We don't put the pressure off because a ceasefire is called. We must organize beyond ceasefire, because ceasefire doesn't equal survival, and it certainly doesn't equal our liberation.
Wow. Yeah. We are going to have to end in just about 30 seconds. Nora, I want to give you an opportunity to chime in, and then we're going to have to wrap it up. Thank you so much, Nadia.
Yeah, I really appreciate what Nadia said and what she always says. I'm a huge Nadia fan. And I think that this is a really critical moment when we have our eyes and ears open to a genocide that is happening in real time on our phones. And Palestinians have been saying this for 75, almost 76 years, that their struggle is a justified one, that their struggle is a legitimate one, that their struggle is, is something that that should be supported. And that the enemy that they have been facing for nearly a century is the same enemy of, oppressed people in all over the world in many different points of history. Mm-hmm. And what Palestinians are asking for or demanding is that, is that people see their struggle as one of demanding the right to go back home, to live lives with full dignity, to be reconnected to their land, and to not be subjugated by a colonial force. I think that this is a really it's a really intensely horrible time. I mean, just unspeakable horrors that are happening every single minute of every single day in Gaza and the West Bank. And I think it's a turning point in history, and we have to keep our heads up.
Nora and Nadia, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. I could have this conversation with you all day, and I'm going to have to bring you back on. But for now, we're going to have to wrap up. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Jesse.
Thanks so much.
And these are the voices of Nora Barrows Friedman, a staff writer and editor at the Electronic Intifada, along with Nadia Tanous, a researcher, writer, and veteran organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.